This is the Recent Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for coming out. In the wake of massive victories by Donald Trump and Republicans in the 2024 elections, here's a question worth asking. How did the GOP go from being the party of free trade and foreign wars to the party of tariffs and non-interventionism? My guests today are Hiram Lewis and Verlin Lewis, two brothers who are college professors and the authors of the book, The Myth of Left and Right. They argue that the way we talk about the political spectrum misleads and confuses us because it reduces complex coalitions to one or two issues that really aren't representative of what the parties actually stand for. Here is the Reason interview with Hiram Lewis and Verlin Lewis. All right, Hiram Lewis and Verlin Lewis, thank you so much for talking to Reason.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So you guys are brothers. You wrote a book called Myth of Left and Right, which it was, you know, one of the most impressive books or most relevant books that I've read in a very long time when it came out. Reason reviewed it. It showed up in a lot of different places. And now we have this election to talk about. So we're going to talk about how, you know, what is your version of kind of ideology and political coalition building in the book, and how does it map on to the election that we just had? Let me throw this out first, I guess, for Hiram. We'll start with, what's the elevator pitch of Myth of Left and Right?
Yeah, so I can make it real simple and real concise. Our thesis is this, that there's more than one issue in politics. A political spectrum can only model one issue, therefore we should not be using a political spectrum. It really is that simple. Now, if you think we're being reductive or attacking a straw man, that nobody believes that there's one issue, well, of course they do, because pretty much everybody in their political analysis uses a political spectrum. And if you were to ask people, you know, you ask any politician, why do you agree with your party on everything? They'd say it's because I'm a progressive or I'm a conservative. They, in their minds, there's just one big issue, change. And if you're pro-change, you're a progressive, you're on the left side of the spectrum, and you have the set of views that grow out of a progressive worldview, or you're on the right side of the spectrum, you're a conservative, you don't like change, in which case you have a set of policy positions that grow out of the conservative worldview.
And can you talk a little bit about, I mean, you know, this is obviously, this is, you know, sweet music to my ears, because I'm a libertarian, and we have a totally different but perfectly consistent set of issues that match up altogether. But I mean, this explains why, you know, we pretend as if there is a necessary connection between being in favor of laws against flag burning and bringing down marginal tax rates, right? Or between being a member of a union and your position on abortion, right? Where, I mean, and I mean, the argument is essentially, when we're talking about the left and the right, that there, you know, it's just this, you know, kind of grab bag of issues and positions or impulses. And then we kind of paper, you know, people in those coalitions paper over all the differences in order to, you know, kind of get together and at least get something they want done.
Yeah. And maybe I'll just jump in there, you know, to your question about, you know, as a libertarian, this is music to your ears. And I think it should be to people who care about human liberty and people who care about human freedom, because if what you really care about is restrained government power, limited government, individual freedom, human freedom, you can see how the left-right spectrum really taints people who are in favor of freedom by association, right? So it says that, well, if everyone can be placed on the single line in space, somewhere on the extreme left or center right or extreme right, then we have to place everyone in their position. And so, you know, Milton Friedman is an extreme right winger, according to, you know, conventional wisdom. People who use left right thinking, they say, oh yeah, he's an extreme right winger. And, you know, so is Mussolini and so is Hitler, right? As if you were to take Milton Friedman's positions and fascism, and they are opposites on every single issue. And yet this totalizing framework forces us to say that the opposites are the same, and the same are opposites. So it's not only misleading, but I think it's misleading in a harmful way, especially for people who care about human freedom and limited government.
But can I push on that a little bit? Because it's like, okay, so from a libertarian point of view, I'm interested in liberty. I'm interested in individual liberty. And then there's a presumption that anything the government does is destructive of that. Is that also kind of a false grouping? Because, you know, I don't, you know, you can make this case, you know, that public education actually allows people to participate more fully in society, unless you believe all taxation is theft. You know, certain publicly provided goods will actually allow people to have more liberty in the sense that they will be able to develop their talents and have more choices. Am I off base there, or how do you deal with something like that?
Not a bit. Look, some people think we're against spectra. We're going after the political spectrum. People think, oh, you don't think you can think in terms of binaries. No, there's lots of realms we can talk about binaries in. Talk about binaries in terms of temperature, right? Hot or colder. We can talk binaries in terms of height. People are taller and shorter. We're just saying there's more than one binary in politics. So the binary of more versus less government is a real binary. Unfortunately, that doesn't describe our politics today. The Republicans want more government in some realms. The Democrats want more government in other realms. I mean, people, you know, you have economists saying, no, the fundamental difference between right and left is size of government. Right wing means less government. Left wing means more government. Oh, really? Well, who wanted to defund the police? Who wanted to cut military spending for all those years and was against the Vietnam War, even though that was a government action? So it's not as simple as big government versus small government. And there's many different axes of values. So there's freedom versus authoritarianism, there's realism versus idealism, there's change versus preservation. There's literally hundreds of axes we can talk about. And yet here are people pretending in the most foolish way that all of politics is about just one axis. It's just about one big thing. We call this political monism, and we say it's the most destructive political myth of our time.
Has it gotten worse? I mean, the concept, and you guys go into this, the book, by the way, is incredibly readable. And I remember it, you know, and this is particularly rare among nonfiction books, but when, you know, when you realize like it's almost over, it's like, oh, damn it. Like, you know, I got to slow down or something, like, you know, what you do when you're reading Harry Potter novels or something. So, you know, good on you for all of that. But you go into the history of, you know, the left and the right categories, you know, emerge from the French Revolution or after the French Revolution and things like that. But are we getting worse? Is our definition, you know, is our definition of politics becoming more monistic, more one-dimensional? You know, certainly there are arguments to be made that we're more polarized, or that, you know, we are more, you're either with us or against us, you know, based on one single issue among, you know, a wide constellation of things. But is there reason to believe that we are becoming more rigid in that left-right kind of spectrum?
Yeah, I think the evidence is pretty clear that the hostility that Americans feel towards the other political party has increased dramatically over the last half century. The hatred and the fear and the anger that people feel in politics has increased. But we can also measure the increasing use of these terms left-wing and right-wing. So you can actually do it just using Google Ingram. How often are these terms used in English language publications? And what we see is an exponential increase in recent decades of use of these terms. So today you can't open a newspaper, you can't turn on television news or go on social media without seeing these terms: left-wing, right-wing, progressive, yeah, conservative.
What is driving that? What's driving the increase, do you think?
Well, I think there's a few things that we point to. One of the reasons that it's become so attractive to people is because it allows people to pretend that they are philosophers when they're really being partisan, right? So it allows us to hide our tribalism.
That is the only instance in which being a philosopher is a sought-after occupation, right? It seems, particularly in contemporary America.
Being principled, right? I mean, as opposed to, nobody wants to be a lemming. You don't want to say, I agree with the Democratic Party on everything because I'm a conformist and can't think for myself. You're saying, no, I'm principled. I'm a progressive. Mm-hmm. So you sell yourself the fiction. Sorry, Verlin, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, that's exactly what I was going to say. So I think that is really appealing to people to say, even though their political party is actually changing their issue positions all the time, and they go along with those changes and what the party believes and stands for, they don't have to tell themselves, oh, I'm just a partisan hack doing whatever my party believes. It's like, no, I'm actually a principled progressive or a principled.
Right, so you're saying that, you know, Republicans who are now gung-ho about tariffs, you know, aren't lemmings, but we'll get to that kind of those issue sets in a second as they relate to the Democratic and Republican parties. But can I ask as a follow-up about the use of terms like I'm a left-winger, I'm a right-winger, or this person is a progressive or a conservative or whatever. Is there a way of tracking? Do people use them more to signal who they are, or do they use it more as a term of invective to like kind of minimize the impact and influence or believability of somebody else?
Well, you won't be surprised to know that when people refer to themselves, they use terms like progressive and conservative. Those sound nice. Those sound honorable. But as soon as they're talking about people in the other party, suddenly they say right-wing, left-wing extremist, because you wouldn't call Hitler a conservative, but you would call him a extreme right-winger, right? So we start to lapse into the wing language and the extreme language. And one of the most common tropes, I mean, everybody believes this in the elite circles. All of my colleagues believe it. Every single journalist I know of in these kind of elite cloistral circles believe it, is that the Republican Party has moved to the extreme right. There is no evidence that this is true. It's complete nonsense. It's either meaningless, which is our position, or demonstrably false.
Okay, so how do you measure that? And then we'll start talking about politics, contemporary politics, but how do you measure to say, the Republicans haven't moved to the extreme right, or have they moved rightward or leftward, or talk a little bit about
that? Yeah, so let's unpack that. So look, government spending, Ronald Reagan cut government spending from 21% of GDP to 18% of GDP, and he was dubbed a radical right-winger for these terrible, radical cuts in government. I, like you, I'm a libertarian. I actually think those cuts in government were positive. Okay, but then along comes Bush and Trump, and they go from 18% of GDP to 26% of GDP. Way more increase than Ronald Reagan cut. And yet here we are saying they moved the party to the right. This is absurd. If small government is right-wing, then they moved the party decisively and unambiguously to the left. Furthermore, on gay marriage, the percentage of Republicans who favored gay marriage in the 1980s was less than 1%. Today, it's well over 50%. It's like an infinite increase. That is an extreme move to the left. And yet here we are saying the move to the right. On foreign policy, George W. Bush invades Iraq and people say, oh, what a right-winger, what a right-wing thing to do. Donald Trump comes along and says, we shouldn't have invaded Iraq. We shouldn't be sending our military overseas. And people are saying he's moved even further to right. This is absurd. Now, the comeback to this is, well, those are just three issues, and there's lots of issues, to which we say, hallelujah, brother, you have seen the light. There is more than one issue in politics, so why in heaven's name are we talking about politics as if it's about one thing, left or right, when it's about hundreds of things?
So how do we, and it's not like there's a commission that decides this, or a French academy or something, but how do we, what issues increase to a level of salience where it's like, okay, well, this is what's defining the party, so maybe, among conservatives, not conservatives, Republicans, abortion, being anti-abortion, rose to a level where if you were a pro-choice politician at the national level, you essentially couldn't be a Republican. And if you were anti-abortion, it was very hard to be a Democrat. Like, how do we plot what issues kind of pop up to start having, casting a bigger shadow to say, if you believe this, then you are that, regardless of anything else?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think there's usually a lot of different issues that are really salient at any given time. But you're right, some issues take on more salience than others, right? So in the 1930s, for example, it seemed like the one big issue was the New Deal. If you were in favor of the New Deal, then you called yourself a liberal or on the left. If you were against the New Deal, then you called yourself a conservative or on the right. Well, they didn't actually originally call themselves conservatives. They kept calling themselves liberals. It took until the 50s or 60s for people to say, yeah, I'm a conservative. In the 1950s, maybe it was McCarthyism was the big issue. In 1960s, it could have been civil rights. And there's a multiplicity of issues. I think right now, a big issue is immigration. I think inflation is a big issue. So we can talk about some of those different issues.
Just to dilate on that for a second, I'm thinking in the 60s, I mean, this is, I guess Hiram had brought this up about war and things like that. You have somebody like LBJ, who is everybody's idea of a liberal, of a modern liberal, a big government liberal. Then people stumble over the idea that, okay, he supported civil rights, but he also jacked up the Vietnam War. And it was like, no, and then he provided Medicare, or he pushed Medicare through. You start to realize very quickly that, yeah, it gets confusing if you're just saying, that these are not more complicated coalitions that somebody is building than not, right?
Yeah. And I mean, imagine, look, every complex realm of life, we go granular. I mean, people say, well, we have to have a political spectrum to simplify things. No, we don't. When we do recreation, we don't say, where are you on the left or the right of recreation? You know, we talk about mountain biking or video game playing or jumps, you know, hopscotch, whatever it happens to be. When in medicine,
those are all right wing, yeah. You know, I don't know. I mean, because, yeah. You know, what has happened is sadly, I mean, in a lot of ways, you know, more and more things get roped into this spectrum type stuff, right? So like if you are a snowboarder, that's, you know, that's politically and ideologically distinct from being a skier, right? Or I you know, I don't know. It's like
well, it just shows you how the social theory has taken hold. So our thesis is there are lots of issues in politics, but people think there's only one because there is a correlation between distinct issues. If I know your view on abortion, I have a pretty good idea of what your view is on taxes on the rich too. So why the correlation? Now people say, oh, there must be some philosophy behind it. There must be some disposition or worldview. And we're saying, no, it's social. And therefore, since there are indeed social groups, well, then you will also find correlation between political parties and political positions and certain activities, right? If you're a vegan, for instance, I can have a pretty good idea of your politics as well.
Well, is that good enough though for, you know, for kind of not government work, but for talking about people's belief in government? Like if you can extrapolate, I don't know, with, you know, like 75% accuracy, if you're a vegan, you probably, you know, here are 10 other things and I can probably pick 7 or 8 that you agree with. Is that good enough? You know, or, you know, why shouldn't we talk about a spectrum then, or about people grouping together based on kind of shared interests?
Yeah, so we would say it's not good enough, and there's better ways to talk about politics, right? Because there's other labels you can use to refer to the social group, which is what you're really doing when you're saying, oh, the left is doing this or the right is doing that. You could just talk about Democrats and Republicans, or Team Blue and Team Red, because that implies something true, which is that we're talking about a group of people who are gathering together to achieve certain common ends. And we recognize that this group of people will change over time and their issue positions will change over time. But when we use the language of left and right or progressive and conservative, we're implying something false. We're implying that there's a trans-historical philosophy that's binding together all the things that currently fly under the banner of left wing or currently fly under the banner of right wing, and that these things have to go together in a certain way. And we think this is harmful because it creates not only the confusion that we've talked about, but a lot of the tribalism that you, I think, alluded to earlier, which is that people say, oh, I'm on this side of a spectrum. All my issue positions flow out of being on the correct side of this one big issue, and I'm correct about everything. And the other party is on the wrong side of the spectrum, and their issue positions all flow out of this bad philosophy, and they're wrong about everything. And so that, I think, leads to a lot of the statism and the totalitarianism that we see in our politics, because it says, look, this is just a struggle between good and evil, all the good people on one side, all the bad people on the other, all the ends justify the means, and whatever it takes, we have to destroy our opponents. And
yeah, you know, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, Nick. I was just going to say, if I can chime in for a second, you know, say, well, why not? I mean, if it gives you a probability of knowing what somebody believes, if I know you supported the Iraq War, I have a pretty good idea of how you feel about abortion. You know, probability is good enough. No, it's not. Why not have 100% certainty? I mean, that's like a doctor saying, well, if you come in and you're obese, I know you have a higher than average probability of having diabetes. That's not good enough. You have to test them for diabetes. And so somebody who finds out that Nick is in favor of small government and then saying, oh, well, this warmonger who supported the Iraq War, I'm sorry, that's not good enough to talk about Nick's policy. Instead, you say, Nick is for smaller government. Nick was against the Iraq War. Be specific. That's what we do in every other realm of life. It's not too hard to do in politics.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, part of this is that depending on, you know, when you were talking about when you were for or against the Iraq War, you're going to have dramatically different results, right? John Kerry, you know, the spectacularly failed presidential candidate for the Democratic Party said, I was for the war before I was against it. You know, so things change. And I guess before we talk specifically about election stuff, this is a point of minor embarrassment. My older son was a political science major as an undergrad. And like when he started, you know, I've been a political journalist for over 30 years and I don't know certain theories that I should have known a long time ago, but he was saying, and you guys hammer this home in your book that like, you know, once you identify as a member of a team or a group, or a tribe, like you'll change your views rather, you know, if the tribe says, okay, we're not in favor of that war anymore, and we, in fact, we've always been against it, you'll change your view rather than change your tribe. Can you talk a little bit about why does that, like, how does that work on either an individual level or a collective level? It would seem, you know, when you enter a party, and I know a lot of people, you know, the Iraq War was a very good example of this over the past, you know, in the 21st century, where people became activated into politics because they were either very for it or very against it. And then their parties change, but they don't change their parties. Like, what's going on with that?
Yeah. So the human capacity for self-deception is enormous, which is a really sad thing, right? I don't think people are lying when they change their views. I think they really think, no, I'm being a consistent conservative, or I'm being a consistent progressive. Now, the parties have every incentive in the world to propagate this myth. They love you to think that when you vote for their party, you're voting for a philosophy or for a set of policies that grow out of a righteous worldview. If you're on the left, you care about social justice. Therefore, donate to the Democratic Party, vote for the Democratic Party, because everything we believe stands for social justice. The reality is that the Democratic Party stands for a random basket of a whole bunch of different things that are unrelated. If you tell that to people, you're much less likely to get them fired up and wanting to go out to elect. So yeah, it is pretty interesting. You put people in a laboratory and you can make them change their mind just by giving them different social cues. You can make conservatives support a higher minimum wage if you tell them that Donald Trump supports it. You can make them support a lower minimum wage if you tell them Donald Trump supports it. People will move all over the place, and then they will deceive themselves after the fact with stories. Ooh, well, a higher minimum wage would conserve a lifestyle, and that's conservative. Oh, a lower minimum wage would conserve free markets, and I believe in conserving free markets. You can make up a conservative or a progressive story to justify any policy.
Well, let's talk about the Democrats, you know, and then we'll talk more about the GOP and about Trump, who's, you know, a fascinating figure for any number of reasons, not simply because, you know, he's pulled a Grover Cleveland, and not simply by filling out his suit pretty, you know, pretty full. You know, how do you map the basic theory of myth of left and right onto what happened to the Democrats in this election? Is there a way to kind of thread that needle?
Well, I would say, you know, one of the interesting things about the parties and the myth of left and right is it does promote this kind of tribalism that we mentioned. Because if you think about, for most of American history, and you mentioned this earlier about how increasing use of left wing and right wing, but for most of American history, we didn't use these terms, left wing and right wing. No one thought and talked about politics in terms of a left-right framework until the 1930s. And it really took off in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s until it's ubiquitous today. But for most American history, people kind of kept their political parties in the sense that, look, this is a political party that I identify with because it has more of the stuff I like than the other political party. But I'm not deluding myself into thinking that everything that my party believes is better than everything that the other party believes. Right. But once you adopt left-right thinking...
And if I may, you know, it's also true that kind of the general theory is of in politics, if you wanted to be a national party, you had to represent everybody in the country, at least a little bit, because otherwise, like, you know, why would people who are, you know, only interested in manufacturing, what would they, you know, how would they appeal to people in the South? I mean, you know, I think partly because it was so dominant for so long, but the Democratic Party in America before the Civil Rights Movement is fascinating, where you have people like Franklin Roosevelt. And then, you know, then you have, like, you know, who's an urbanist and, you know, a manufacturing, interested in manufacturing stuff, very urban, you know, teaming up with people who were super racist and super rural, like agrarians, but they were all Democrats, right? Because the party had to cover everybody.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Democratic Party's problem in this election was precisely the myth of left and right. They bought into it. In their view, Donald Trump is a right-wing extremist. What they failed to understand is there's a difference between process extremism and policy extremism. Now, I prefer, I fear process extremism more than I fear policy extremism. That's why I voted for Harris, because Trump is definitely a process extremist.
What do you mean by process extremist?
Well, the way by which your policies get through. So undemocratic means to certain ends, right? He was much more undemocratic, at least in his rhetoric. And so, you know, and certainly in his actions after January 6th and these kinds of things. So So yeah, the process extremism is real, but because of the myth of left and right, they couldn't see that process extremism is different than policy extremism. And when you look at Donald Trump, he is definitely not a policy extremist. They got blindsided by this. He captured the median voter because he holds the positions of the median voter. When you're saying the Republican Party has moved to the right, oh, they've adopted extreme policies, it's simply not true. And yet all of the Democratic operatives were thinking in terms of the myth of left and right. So they had that in their heads. You go down the list of things that Trump believes. He believes in closing the southern border. So does a majority of the American people. He believes in tariffs. So does a majority of the American people. His view on race is much closer to the American people than Kamala Harris, despite all the rhetoric about him being a fascist and these kinds of things. So they were blindsided because they bought into the myth of left and right and couldn't craft an electoral strategy around what Trump actually was, which is a process and not policy. Right.
And even they seem to be moving away from kind of a more progressive identity politics focused emphasis in their convention. I mean, you know, obviously Harris, you know, any presidential election you win or lose for a ton of reasons, including things that are beyond your control, but, and she was paying for the sins of, you know, the past 4 years, good and bad. But at the convention, she was not talking to Latinx people. She was not foregrounding identity politics. She was not foregrounding opposition to Israel, which seemed to be very popular among certain elements of the Democratic establishment, if not the rank and file. Verlin, who did you vote for, if I may ask, since your brother?
I did a write-in. I couldn't pull myself to go for either of the two. I was a weasel.
Who did you write in?
My daughter convinced me to vote for the president of our church, so I went with that.
Oh, okay, yeah. I know a number of people who wrote in Javier Milei, which I thought was kind of clever if they weren't going for anybody who's actually American. But where would you, if you are recommending to the Democrats, and, you know, they're at least for the next couple of days, they're going to think hard and, you know, do an autopsy after losing this election. And it is kind of fascinating that, you know, this was not a close election, you know, particularly, and Trump surged, or, you know, in most counties in America, in most parts of the country, like, you know, I'm not saying it was an embrace of Trumpism per se, but it was clearly a repudiation of how the Democratic Party was perceived. What do they need to learn from this election that might help them clarify who they are and how to attract people?
Well, I think they need to learn that if they can't diagnose the problem, they can't write a prescription that will fix the problem. So I think this is, you know, I feel bad for the American voters right now. I think whether you voted for Harris or you voted for Trump, I think most people would agree we'd rather have had better options than were presented to us. And I think people can't figure out how to get better candidates because they can't really diagnose the problems. Like, I'm very sympathetic to the concerns that Trump voters talked about in the election. I just don't think Trump is the answer to what ails them. So they complained about inflation. I also am complaining about inflation. I think it's really undermining purchasing power for ordinary Americans. But I don't think electing someone who has, when he was previously president, set records for government spending, government deficits, who promised to and fulfilled promises to impose tariffs on imports, these are all inflationary policies. And unfortunately, I think we're going to get more of it over the next 4 years with the Republican Congress. Inflation is not going to go away by electing Trump. You know, you can just go down the list, whatever the issue is. I am sympathetic to concerns about the obsessions with identity politics and the concerns that, you know, wacky theories of intersectionality are dominating the academy in Hollywood. But why would we nominate someone for president who is obsessed with national origin and race and ethnic identity, right? That's not going to make the problem go away. I think it's only going to make the problem worse in our society. So all these things, I'm sympathetic with the concerns. Yeah. I just don't think Trump is the answer.
But Nick, are you, yeah, go ahead. Sorry. You're asking about how we would advise the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, they need to embrace pluralism. One of the biggest problems of the political spectrum is it tells you have all the answers. you've got it all. Once you have said, I'm on the left wing, and the left wing stands for social justice, well, then everything considered left wing is necessarily good. I don't have to listen to anybody else. There's nothing to learn. I'm omniscient. I have all the answers. No wonder there's so much cancel culture on college campuses. These young people say, I already know everything. By golly, I'm 19 years old, but I've got it all figured out because I've chosen the correct side of the spectrum. So I would tell the Democrats, get rid of the spectral thinking and embrace pluralism. Bring in people, both pro and anti-tariff people, and listen to them. Bring critics of critical race theory in to the discussion. Bring in people who disagree with you. Dissent is valuable
that, as an ideological tool. That sounds, yeah, that is awesome. But then as a political party, when you start to advance a kind of national agenda, do you say, here are the three big things that we as Democrats agree on and are going to push? As opposed to saying, you know, here is an endless laundry list of, you know, of things that may or may not be relevant to virtually anybody in this coalition.
Well, just really quick, and then I want to hear what Verlin has to say. But I mean, they have to understand there's a difference between means and ends. If they say, look, we Democrats really believe in ending poverty, fantastic. I don't disagree with you. But that doesn't necessarily mean that just throwing infinite amounts of government money is necessarily the solution to that problem. So mm-hmm. bring in other people who are talking about, you know, market and vouchers and other mm-hmm. approaches to anti-poverty. That's what we mean by pluralism. It doesn't mean sacrificing your principles. It doesn't mean saying, hey, we don't stand for racial justice, or we don't stand for ending poverty or greater equality. Before all those things. But we have to be pluralistic in how we approach it, because nobody has the answer about how to get at the ends that we all agree on are good. Verlin, I'm sorry I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to add that, yeah, we really do see the distinction here in frameworks between pluralism and monism. So monism is what underlies left-right thinking. It says there's just one issue, and how you stand on that one issue determines everything else. Instead of that, we argue for pluralism, recognizing that there's many issues in politics, and there's hundreds of ways to bundle together those different issue positions. And when you take a pluralist view, then you recognize that our two parties will also, as a matter of course, be pluralist. They will be pluralist coalitions. And when they are pluralistic, they don't have to agree on everything, but as to your point, they can find a few things that they agree on. So, you know, you talked about the Democratic Party. Historians sometimes point to Martin Van Buren as the founder of the Democratic Party, you know, at the time of Andrew Jackson. And he writes this letter where he says, we need to have a coalition party that will bring together the common man of the North and the planters of the South. He recognized from the get-go that these people didn't have to work together, but they could if we brought them together into a coalition. And if you go back and read party platforms from the 19th century, even the early 20th century, much shorter than they are today, because they didn't have to agree on everything. You know, here's the three or dozen or whatever it was things that we all agree on, and we recognize that we don't agree on everything else. But I think that's a better kind of politics. So rather than coming into office and saying, we're going to do these 1,000 things, and because we won, we're going to shove our policies down your throat. It's like, here's a few things that a lot of Americans can agree on, and we're going to pursue those few things.
Before we continue with the recent interview, I want to tell you about today's sponsor, ZBiotics. This is a game-changing product that you can use before a night out. Do you think you need to make a choice between having a great night or a great next day? ZBiotics might make a huge difference for you. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in your gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. ZBiotics produces an enzyme that breaks this byproduct down. All you have to do is remember to make ZBiotics your first drink of the night and then drink responsibly. Try it out and see a difference the next day. I don't drink, but I'll tell you what, a friend of mine who does recently cracked open ZBiotics when we were out. And I said, hey, does it work? She told me, yes, it really works. Go to ZBiotics.com/TRI to get 15% off your first order. Use that code ZBiotics.com/TRI at checkout. TRI stands for the recent interview. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money without asking any questions. Once again, head to ZBiotics.com/TRI. and you're going to get 15% off at checkout. Now, back to the Reason interview. Let's talk about the Republicans now, because, you know, in the flush of a big victory, I don't think they're going to be interested in being pluralistic, right? Because, you know, they won. How do we make sense of Donald Trump? I mean, I think he perfectly vindicates your thesis that there is not an essence to, you know, political points on the political spectrum among the party, because when Trump, you know, who has only been a major political figure for, you know, 9 years, is that right? Yeah. I mean, he emerged in 2015, the Republican Party, the thing we knew is they stood for free trade. They stood for, immigration, orderly immigration, but they liked immigration. They were pro-war. They loved the military and they loved dropping bombs and invading countries and things like that. And that doesn't seem to be true anymore at all, right?
Yeah. And the common way people think of this is they say, well, you know, Mitt Romney, when he ran in 2012, he was a moderate conservative, center right. And Donald Trump, he's an extreme conservative, extremely right wing. So think through the logic of that. So according to this view, if Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan were moderately in favor of cutting government spending, does that mean Donald Trump is extremely in favor of cutting government spending? The opposite. When he was president, he drastically increased government spending. You know, Romney and Ryan were moderately in favor of cutting deficits. Does that mean Trump is extremely in favor of cutting deficits? No, he did just the opposite. They were moderately in favor of free trade, right? You can go down the line. It doesn't make any sense to say that this is center right and this is extremely right, because there's more than one issue. You just have to look at
that. It seems impossible that Trump would have emerged as a Democrat, even though he was a Democrat, you know, I guess in the 80s and maybe through part of the 90s. Can we figure out what is it that makes him, it's impossible to see him as a Democrat? And is it the way that he talks about racial and ethnic issues? Is it the way, you know, I think it was the first or second thing he said when he came down the escalator, and he said, the two big things were, you know, he talked about Mexicans being rapists and drug dealers and, you know, criminals, and some of them are, you know, not terrible people. But then the other thing he said is like, I'm not politically correct. And that seemed to mean, okay, well, you cannot be a Democrat. Is that a legitimate essence within the Republican coalition to be like, okay, we are the party of being politically incorrect?
Absolutely not. Look, I can totally imagine Donald Trump being a Democrat. The Democratic Party was far more racist than the Republican Party until very recently, until the 1960s. Anti-immigration wanted to close the southern border. That used to be more a Democratic priority because they were the party of the working man, wanted to keep wages high. The more immigrants you admit with low skills, the more it's going to drive down low-skilled labor wages in the United States. So I can totally see Trump being a Democrat. It just depends on time and place. And at this time and place, he exploited some fissures in the Republican Party to get the nomination.
Do you, how long does, within the Republican Party now, and, you know, one of Trump's advisors, and, you know, we'll see how long this lasts, but at his rally at Madison Square Garden, he talked about how Robert F. Kennedy Jr., you know, the scion of, you know, two of the great Democratic demigods in American politics, who literally can't give a speech without invoking his uncle and his father, who were, you know, major figures who were both assassinated. They weigh heavily on the American psyche and certainly on his. He was a Democrat who sought the Democratic nomination, then an independent, and now he is Trump's right-hand man. Does that show the malleability of these coalitions? And he's pushing, you know, he's pushing that we have to make America healthy again. MAHA is the next iteration of MAGA. Is that going to last very long, or is Trump, the patron saint of Chick-fil-A and McDonald's, going to be like, get the hell out of here? I want to eat my fast food.
Yeah, it's interesting how the issues that are really salient right now and the stances that the two parties take on them. We think that, of course, that's the stance that Republicans would take on vaccines, and of course, that's the stance Democrats would take on vaccines. But of course, this is all historically contingent, and if we'd had a different president in the White House when the pandemic broke out, you can easily imagine the two tribes having taken different positions. In fact, if you go back to, I think it was 2016 when Marianne Williamson was running as a nominee for the Democratic Party and had kind of this anti-vaccine stance. And she, you know, it was all of a piece of you know, being against, you know, big pharma and being, you know, against the unhealthy aspects of capitalism and degradation of the economy and all these kinds of, or of the environment. And I think Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is one of those that's, you know, was kind of pro-environment was one of his big things, right? And healthy. And but that could be Republican or Democrat. It just happened to be that Trump was in office when the pandemic broke out. And so being kind of anti-vaccines ended up being a Republican position and being pro-vaccines.
Yeah, and I mean, Trump specifically, you know, I mean, he simultaneously was kind of talking about, well, we don't really need vaccines, but he started Operation Warp Speed. And in the fall of 2020, Kamala Harris, of all people, said, I'm not going to take a Trump vaccine if it comes online before the election, because that would be too quick. And you could have, I mean, it's very easy to imagine a world where Donald Trump says, I created these vaccines. These are my vaccines. They're good things. They're saving people. And then many people in the Republican Party who are now anti-vaccine and questioning pharma would be on the other side of the issue completely.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, there's a lot of flux. You're talking about how do the parties change? It's basically just interest groups. There's new interest groups and new issues that emerge, and the parties want to capture those interest groups. There's nothing wrong with that. We have two baskets, two parties, and they're going to have different products. The funny thing is, though, you'll take a product that is in one basket. So basket A looks over basket B and says, gee, Twinkies, that's disgusting. Who would ever eat Twinkies? And then suddenly the Twinkies get thrown into basket A, and they'll start saying, oh, I always love Twinkies. Twinkies are actually healthy for you because you eat a little bit of Twinkie and it makes you more geared up to eat your healthy food. But they'll invent stories. And that's exactly what's happening in politics. Now, we are not against that flux. That flux is natural. It's part of the two-party system. That's okay. What we're against is the delusion and the storytelling and the saying, oh, I like Twinkies all along. Oh, I'm still a conservative, even though I have the opposite views I had recently. I'm still being every bit as philosophical. It's tribalism, not philosophy. All we're asking is that people recognize that. People think we're against the two-party system. We're not. Have two parties, but have two parties without delusions. Currently, we have the delusion that the Republican Party is bound together in all of their issue positions and all their voters and all their interest groups by this philosophy of conservatism. That is nonsense. Progressive, you know, the Democratic Party is under the delusion that they are bound together by this quest for social justice and progressivism. That is delusion. My colleagues in history, almost like 98% of them consider themselves progressives. Yes, I am saying that 98% of them are deluded. Start thinking for yourself. Stop thinking in terms of a magic line because it doesn't exist.
I suspect you're not that popular among your colleagues. Hiram, I'm just guessing.
Well, as long as I'm popular with you, Nick, that's all that matters.
Let's talk a little bit about biography. I mean, you guys are brothers. You grew up in, where did you grow up?
Oregon.
And am I right to assume that you're Mormon?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're part of that. Like, how does that play into this? Because, you know, that presents an interesting perspective where Mormons are on, and I realize I may be speaking offensively here, I don't mean to, but simultaneously like super American, right? And, you know, people like Harold Bloom, the literary scholar, talked about how Mormonism is the ultimate American religion, partly because, you know, it's fully formed here, et cetera. But it's like you're simultaneously very American, very kind of middle of the road or like the archetypal American, but also outsiders. Talk a bit about where you're from and how that influences how you think about things.
Well, yeah, maybe I'll start by saying, you know, this our membership in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I think, is maybe important here because it gives both of us an allegiance or a commitment to something that is more important to us than political party affiliation. So I think it allows us a little bit to take a step back from the two parties and say, if the two parties change their positions on a variety of issues, how does that match up with my faith? How does that match up with what's most important to me? And I'm willing to change my party affiliation or what party I vote for based on in what ways they match up with or go away from the things that are most important to me. One of the problems that we see in our contemporary political system is the increase in tribalism. And I think this is partly a result of increasingly people have less and less of an attachment to traditional communities, traditional sources of meaning, traditional identity.
Certainly so, traditional religions, right? Or religion has lost its hold over the public imagination in a significant way.
Yeah, and people have a religious-shaped hole in their heart, right? They have to have a spiritual connection in some sense. And so they will often find their religion if it's not traditional religion in something else like a political ideology. And so people find a lot of, I think, meaning and connection with, oh, I'm a progressive or I'm a conservative, and that's what gives me meaning. That's who I am. That's what's most important. And we think that's an unhealthy kind of tribalism. Look, human beings are tribal by nature. We have to belong to groups. We just think there's healthier groups and less healthy groups. And we think the left and right groups are unhealthy.
And is it that foregrounding of politics as the primary kind of focus of meaning and community? Is that the problem?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, people do. You don't need me to tell you this, right? I mean, the political parties today function like churches, and people are committed to their political views. I mean, the reactions of people after the loss, it's as if, you know, the Catholics just lost the Crusades or something. They just, you know, they have this devastation because it is their faith. It gives their lives meaning. And so how did our background help to inform us about our book? I think in a number of ways, but it's not only how we were brought up, but it was where we were brought up. We were brought up in Eugene, Oregon. So here we grew up in this college town, extremely blue in its politics, and yet our parents were extremely red. So I would go to school and my teachers, all Democrats, would draw this line on the chalkboard and say, here's the political spectrum. The Democrats are here on the center left, the Republicans are here on the center right, but you take the right wing view too far and you become Hitler. And here's Hitler out on the far right because, and I'm just thinking that my parents are not like Hitler. I don't get this. This is not making a lot of sense. And so very early, I learned to question this way of looking at politics, and it's only become more pronounced since then.
Do you, in a sense, politics is film. I mean, politics is a new religion, but is it true that within religions, religion sheds? I was raised Catholic, and it's interesting. I was born in 1963, right around the time that Vatican II was kind of taking place. But the Catholic Church that my parents, who were born in the 20s, were born and raised in was radically different than the one that I was raised in, but they stayed Catholic. Are religions subject to the same kind of tribal allegiances where you retcon the story after it changes dramatically so that there's a sense of continuity, but it's really kind of fictional as well?
Well, I think one of the problems that we have in our contemporary political society is the politicization of so many realms of life you talked about, right? It seems like we can't separate politics from our personal lives. And this is seeping into a lot of churches. A lot of churches are taking a stand and saying, well, if there's just one big issue and you have to be on the left or the right, we're gonna put our stake in the ground. We're on this side of the spectrum. And then we're going to adopt a lot of positions that we otherwise would never have adopted. But because this tribe believes in all these things, we have to be with the tribe on all of these things. And so I think the politicization of churches has been a big problem.
Well, and whether or not there's a, you know, our church is subject to change, of course, right? I mean, yeah. Our church had a priesthood ban on African-Americans mm-hmm. until 1978. Right. Thankfully, that was lifted. However, there is a core of doctrine beneath those fluctuating policies that has persisted. Mm-hmm. You look at, your Catholic church, for all the changes that it's undergone.
And I'm saying this mostly to insulate them from association with me, but I'm not a practicing Catholic, so it's not my church.
Your parents' faith, they've changed a lot, but they haven't changed in their view of the divinity of Christ. They haven't changed in their view of the Trinity. They haven't changed in their view, the Bible is still the Bible. So there
I don't want to get into trouble with the Catholics, the Bible, the hardcore Catholics at Reason, but they did in 1950, they changed the doctrine about Mary and her being conceived without, absent original sin. So,
There's flux, but not as much flux.
I hear you. I hear you completely. How do you think the Republican coalition? Because it's probably easier, it's easier to kind of rethink your commitments and your identity and to be kind of more pluralistic when you are out of power than when you are in power, because the stakes are lower, right? Do you think, within the Republican party right now, and just within Donald Trump, you have a mix of people like Mike Pompeo, who is very much a kind of like military industrial deep state interventionist type mindset, and then you have people who are coming at it from a very a kind of neo-isolationist wing. You have people who are free traders and pro-immigrant, and people who really want to round up as many immigrants as possible. You have people like RFK wandering through. What do we look for to see like where the seams start to explode, where the story that we're telling ourselves or the story that Republicans are telling themselves, why they won and why it's all a unified field theory, is going to explode?
Well, I might just on that point about how when they get into power, why does Republicans and Democrats seem to change more than maybe other political groups like libertarians you mentioned earlier? It does seem like there's more consistency. I think one of the reasons is because it's only Republicans and Democrats that win elections and control power. And what we know about human nature is that human beings like to exercise power when they have it. And so even if a candidate campaigns on being non-interventionist in some realm, once they have the power to exercise, they're like, well, maybe I will intervene now, actually. So, and there's lots of examples of this. We all lived through this with George W. Bush in the 2000 presidential election. He, you know, famously pledged to have a humble foreign policy. The Republican Party platform that year explicitly criticized Clinton and Gore administration for having an interventionist foreign policy, for trying to be the world's policeman. But then once Republicans won the White House, they're like, oh, actually, it's kind of nice being the president. We can exercise this power and let's send troops around the world. And they went back on everything that they said they were going to do in the 2000 election. There's so many examples of this. Even the New Deal is one people don't really realize. In 1932, the Democratic Party was the less interventionist party when it came to economic policy. They criticized the Republicans for centralizing too much power in Washington, D.C., busting the budget for too high of taxes. These are the kinds of things that FDR ran on. That was the platform in 1932. If you go back and read it, it's fascinating. Once he gets into power and Democrats have control of the national government, well, here comes the New Deal, right? They did all that they criticized Republicans for doing, but even more. And that's
so just to follow up on that, because I'm interested in these moments when the stories, like the magic in the stories, no longer work. So, you know, you're talking about FDR. I'm talking to you from New York, a couple miles from where Al Smith, his great mentor, you know, came from. And you know, the first great kind of immigrant, guttural kind of politician in America. He ended up breaking, you know, he defined the Democratic Party as the Democrats were becoming the party of urban America. They had been the party of, like, you know, kind of rural farmers in the South and whatnot. And then suddenly Al Smith, who talked like one of the Bowery boys, you know, ran for president and lost in, like, up to that point, the biggest wipeout ever, because he was too urban, too Democrat, too Catholic, too everything. He ends up breaking with FDR during the New Deal. What, you know, how does that happen? Or, like, you know, what do we look for when we see these big breaks and something new and different emerges in politics?
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead. Sorry, I was going to say it's harder to do now because, like Verlin mentioned, the lift of left and right is much more pronounced. So in Al Smith's time, this myth was in its infancy. Almost nobody talked in terms of left wing and right wing. So when there was a policy departure, when the Democratic Party moved from being small government to big government, a small government guy like Al Smith could say, this is no longer my party, and step out. You don't see that happening now because the myth of left and right papers over the differences. So we talked about the individual incentives to embrace the myth of left and right. It lets you be lazy. You don't have to think. You just sign up for your party and say, ooh, I'm so principled. You know, and it allows you to be tribal without feeling tribal. It does all these things individually. But on the institutional level, the myth of left and right keeps the Al Smiths of the world from leaving. How many of my Republican friends used to talk about small government, low tariffs, character in public officials matters, keeping our military strong and sending it abroad to spread democracy is so important. And now they're saying the exact opposite. And yet in their minds, they're being consistently conservative because they cook up these stories, because the myth of left and right tells them that Donald Trump is far right. Now, if you're a partisan, far right sounds bad for most people. But if you're a very partisan Republican, it's news to your ears. It's music to your ears. Every time one of these mainstream media outlets calls Donald Trump far right, they say, oh, I'm going to support him more. Because notice, if right wing is good, then being a little bit right wing is a little bit good. And being extremely right wing is really good. So of course, they're going to embrace Trump and everything he believes with gusto, because they've convinced themselves that right wing is good. So extreme right wing is really good. And it's going to keep them loyal to Trump. So the myth of left and right prevents, you were talking about these fissures and all these different interest groups and all these fractures in the parties. It makes those appear as if they don't exist. So somebody like Trump can govern without seeing fractures in his coalition by spouting the myth of left and right.
As a final topic, I would like to bring up your book in relation to, I remember when I read Myth of Left and Right, I thought a lot about a book that came out a few years ago by a political scientist at Syracuse, I believe, Sam Rosenfeld. book called The Polarizers, Postwar Architects of Our Partisan Era. And he talked about how that theory of if you were going to be a national party, you had to represent everybody in the nation, you know, a little bit, at least a little bit. And that starting in the 50s, really, after World War II, that started to change. And the people who are putting parties together started to say, okay, you know what, what we want is ideological purity in our party. We want to become, rather than kind of demographic or geographic, we want to become ideological. And he actually charts how it really kind of started among Democrats, but then it found its, you know, its fullest expression early on, first through Barry Goldwater and the kind of refashioning of the Republican Party into an ideological grouping, you know, which then, you know, Ronald Reagan. And I guess what my question is, like, you guys are saying, you know, going back to that earlier conception of a political party as looser and as more representative and pluralistic rather than ideological is a good thing. My question isn't even whether that is would be better than what we have, but how do we get there? Because our parties now, we have a liberal party and a conservative party, and real, those labels are doing a lot of, you know, plaster of Paris, filling in cracks and covering seams and everything. But like, how do we get Republicans and Democrats to kind of accept the idea that their coalitions are mostly BS and that they need to think about how they function differently?
Well, I disagree with the premise. I mean, this okay. whole idea, this dominates the scholarship in history too. It says that you used to have this, you know, this center-left consensus in America, the liberal consensus, and then along came Barry Goldwater and messed it all up and moved the Republican Party to the extreme right, and now it's an ideological party. I completely disagree. There's no evidence that that's true. That's just wishful thinking among my Democrat colleagues who want to portray the Republicans to be these really, really evil, bad people. You know, the reality is that the Republican Party today is a coalition of interest groups, and it always has been. The idea that it stopped being, you know, stopped being a coalition and started being ideological is simply not true. So they tell these stories, right? Because rural Americans 100 years ago voted Democrat, or, you know, for the entirety of American history. They voted Democrat until very recently. And so the only solution our colleagues are left with saying is, oh, rural America, now that they're voting Republican, they must have moved to the right. This is nonsense. They haven't moved anywhere. Their priorities, their values compared to urban Americans are the exact same. It's that the parties have changed, not them. And so we say, oh, they become more conservative. No, the meaning of conservative has just changed to accommodate different demographics. And that's what my colleagues don't get. And that's what the author of that book doesn't get. I'm sorry, that's maybe a little too harsh, Verlin. Maybe I'm
I find that, you know, interesting. And, you know, this, one of the things I was just talking to somebody in a different context recently, where, you know, when you start to look for continuity between presidential administrations rather than differences, interesting stuff emerges, you know, so that you could talk about a Carter-Reagan era and find a lot of continuity, you know, particularly when it came towards certain types of regulation and certain types of budget interests and things like that. You know, talking about continuity between George W. Bush and Barack Obama, it kind of makes a lot of sense, really. But we're trained to only see, okay, well, when a new party comes in, everything is new. But, you know, Richard Nixon and LBJ, you know, it's not wrong to say that Nixon, you know, completed the regulatory aspects of the Great Society. And that helps clarify some stuff that otherwise, it doesn't seem to make much sense.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, you know, I think this claim that the Republican Party has become so ideological, I mean,
also the Democrat. I mean, Rosenfeld is saying that the Democrats also tried.
But of course, the question is, well, what is this ideology, right? Because if it's conservatism on the Republican side, say, okay, so Barry Goldwater, you know, he was the first Republican presidential candidate to call himself a conservative. And Donald Trump basically has the opposite positions on every single issue from Barry Goldwater, but we say that they're both ideologues or extremely right-wing, extremely conservative. I just don't think it's useful. I think it confuses more than it clarifies. Because if you go down the list, government spending, deficits, even taxes, you know, you just go foreign policy, whatever it is, they had different issue positions, opposites actually. And yet we say the opposites are the same and we say the same are opposites. It's very confusing.
What do you think about, I've heard this a lot, particularly with Trump, and interestingly from kind of foreign observers, that, you know, the difference between Trump is Trump loves America. whereas the Democrats are critics, and that the Democratic agenda, particularly since George Floyd, say, has been to really heighten all of the failures of America in terms of living up to its promise. Whereas, you would hear this about Barack Obama, actually, you know, that I remember having these insane conversations with people who would say, you know, he's the first president who actively hates America and wants to destroy it. And then Donald Trump, but Donald Trump, the reason why he wins and the people rally around him is because he loves America and he's positive and he sees a future vision. And I guess a roundabout way of or trying to clarify what I'm getting at is, like, how much of political success or failure is this kind of very inchoate vibe, where maybe it's less about policy or even direction and more like, are you optimistic or pessimistic? And then it gets complicated because Donald Trump, on a certain level, you know, he says we're going to get tired of winning, but he's a very dark and foreboding presence who's always talking about how the system doesn't work and how things are terrible. One of you or both of you speak to that?
Yeah. So the bottom line is the stories do persist. And so I guess I'm a little harsh on these political scientists, but if what they're saying is the Republicans started conceiving themselves as a conservative party, that's true. And they started telling a story about we're the conservatives who like to conserve things. And that story persisted even as the policies totally reversed. I mean, you say, oh, Eisenhower was center left, Reagan was far right. They had identical views on size of government. They had identical views on the New Deal. I mean, this is just absurd. But if the story, yes, the stories persist. And the story that is popular among the Democrats right now is the social justice story of oppressor oppressed. And so it makes a moral calculus in their story, in their fairy tale. It makes morality a simple question of who has the power. The more powerful you are, the more evil you are. That's the moral calculus. So if you're looking internationally, well, what's the most powerful nation? It's the United States. And if every difference in everything, any differences in possession or income or wealth or power are the result of evil, then America has to be the most evil country. So it kind of grows out of that. Now, I'm not saying no Democrats are patriotic or they hate America. I'm just saying that their story, the story that they buy into of power differentials are moral differentials, then naturally that's going to lead them to be less pro-American than the Republicans who have this, you know, story that's equally as fictitious about conserving and tradition and these kinds of things.
It's interesting. You can often tell which team someone belongs to based on which story they tell as the key difference between left and right. So I have a political science colleague who's in Team Blue, who at a political science conference said with a straight face that the real difference between left and right is that the left cares about poor people and the right doesn't care about poor people. And that's guess which side of the spectrum he thinks of himself.
The same thing. That would be stunning if he was like, and for that reason, I am a right winger.
Yeah, right. And people in Team Red will say, well, the key difference is the left hates America and the right loves America. And it's just a self-serving story. I mean, Donald Trump doesn't love America. He loves himself.
And McDonald's,
he will trample our Constitution and our traditions for his own vain, glory.
But only to protect America.
Yeah.
How do you guys, how do you maintain, and you both are libertarian-ish, if not, hardcore small L libertarians. How do you do this kind of work without becoming cynical about politics? Because your book is not cynical, your work is not cynical, your affect is not cynical, but it's kind of like, I can see it very easily becoming, God, people are just full of crap and they don't even know it. How do you maintain your, not necessarily idealism, but like engaged optimism?
Well, I'm sorry, Nick, that my cynicism didn't come through because I'm extremely cynical. I'm the most pessimistic guy in the country, at least on a political level. I just think things are terrible and getting worse.
Just for a second, what does that mean, though? They're bad and they're getting worse.
Because the myth of left and right has just gone exponentially upward, and the myth of left and right is poisoning our politics, turning people against each other, reducing compromise, reducing thinking. We need thoughtful politics. We need compromising politics. We need, and it kills all of those things. So I'm cynical in those reasons, but am I optimistic? moments, I look at young people. So people like you who are libertarians, it resonates with. It's like, yeah, this is stupid to think that there's only one issue in politics because you've been called a fascist and things like this. You're like, that's just stupid. Putting me on a spectrum with Adolf Hitler is just dumb. So people like you get it. So libertarians and disaffected Republicans, we seem to get a lot of traction with them. But we also get traction with young people. Young people biologically are more neuroplastic than our older people. And so I guess that's hopeful is when we talk to young people, I've never gotten serious pushback from young people I talk to. Usually they're like, yeah, that sounds about right to me.
Yeah, and I might just add that I sometimes get some hope from thinking historically and thinking that, look, for 99.9% of human history, we didn't think about politics in terms of a left-right spectrum. It's a relatively new phenomenon. For most of American history, we didn't have this way of thinking. And so, you know, if it's lived a little bit, but maybe we can move past it, get on to something else. And so that gives me a little bit of hope. And then, yeah, to Hiram's point.
So it's the equivalent of quadraphonic sound.
Right? Yeah.
You know, it has like maybe a very short window where it seems to be the next big thing.
Yeah, and before humor theory dominated, you know, the most educated doctors and medical scientists for a century, but we got past it. We no longer believe in a silly four humor theory. Hopefully we can get past this and no longer believe in a silly left-right spectrum. But yeah, I mean, I think young people give me some hope. And it also is a reminder when you realize that young people are open to this, is that people don't naturally believe in the left-right spectrum. It's not natural. You have to be taught it. You have to be brainwashed into thinking in terms of a left-right spectrum. And so if we can change the way that people are taught, then they won't end up thinking this way. It has to be propped up. It's artificial. And it's time to kick out the supports on this way of thinking.
All right. That's a good note to end on. I want to thank Hiram Lewis and Verlin Lewis, the authors of Myth and Left and Right. Thank you so much, guys. This was intellectually invigorating.
Thanks, Nick. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Nick.